Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Over the past couple of weeks on the Majlis, we were talking about pre- and post-election dynamics in Kyrgyzstan. Meanwhile, a lot has been happening in the other Central Asian country, Turkmenistan. I think the Asian Games excitement is finally over, but lately President Berdimuhamedov has been busy in taking new decisions. One of them has to do with the People's Council, the rubber stamp group of elders. Today, we will dive into this decision to understand the dynamics behind it. Since we visited Turkmenistan last time, Vladimir Putin also came and gone. We will look into what he was looking for in the cash-strapped Turkmenistan. And then Berdimuhamedov went to Sochi to attend the meeting of the heads of the states of CIS member countries and returned with a new responsibility of co-chairing the CIS. We will try to understand how can he do that while claiming his country remains neutral. Additionally, writings were on the wall for years. I guess it's finally gone for good. I'm talking about free utility services, which are not only cancelled, but prices of some commodities went up by 20 times since then. We will also discuss its implications on the people. Finally, the big question is, when we put all these recent developments in context, what does it really tell us about political and social dynamics? And more importantly, maybe the economic health of the country. And then even the bigger question is, what are Turkmenistan's options? Wow, it's become kind of unusual opening today, but yeah, so a lot to discuss. But first, let me welcome our panel today. After some time, we are happy that our friend, Dr. Lokan Cheshci, chairman of Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow, is joining us, who is also author of the book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. Welcome, Dr. Lokan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And Faruk Yusupi is joining us today from Prague. Excuse him if he sounds a little tired because he is with us despite being ill. I hope this discussion won't hurt him further. Faruk is the director of our Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Turkmen service. Thank you very much, Faruk, for joining us today. And yes, Bruce Spanier is healthy and is in our studios in Prague. He is, as you know, the editor of Kishlok Awozi, which is a blog by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. Thank you very much again, gentlemen, for joining us today.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Faruk. Although it's a little bit late to talk about this, but it is an important topic to cover. I am talking about the post-Asian Games environment in Turkmenistan. Is Turkmenistan happy from the outcome?
It looks like one person is very happy, and that's president of Turkmenistan, dear Arkadak, as people call him. But other people, they are very concerned about their day-to-day lives and the hardships that are becoming harder and harder day by day. We hear from different regions of the country that people are in, it would be probably a strong word, but they are in panic. They are trying to stock up basic staples like sunflower oil, rice, and other basic stuff, because they are very afraid that the prices are going up very soon. And another sign for them being concerned is that for the first time in many years, we were able to confirm that in the northern town of Dashogus, there was a small spontaneous demonstration by women who went to the local administration demanding explanation for why all of a sudden fees for kindergartens rose tenfold from 8 manats to 80 manats. And they were, of course, rounded up and dispersed. And as we hear, there were a few arrests made in Dashogus. So things are heating up, but I don't know what will come out of this, if you ask, because it seems like Turkmen people have very high level of patience.
Yeah. Definitely, we will touch upon, Farouk, you just mentioned very important topic, that is possible connection between the games or the post-games environment with the rising price of some of the commodities. Definitely, we'll get to that. Now, Dr. Luca, in the days leading up to the games, you might have heard us on the Majlis talking about we were focused a lot on possible implications of the game, given that thousands of people will lose their jobs after end of the construction. And here you go. We are 1 month into the post-game era. Has there been any immediate signs that you come across with the way it is impacting on people?
It seems to me that the games are another indicator of the infrastructural fetishism that this regime has. So big constructions, big events, totally useless if you want, a vanity fair, ultimately, with no benefit for the people when the games are ended. And you're right to note that there is a problem now, because all the people that have been working in the construction industry have now lost their jobs.
Yeah.
Which means that I am not entirely sure about the kind of support that they may get from the state.
Mm.
But from what I understand, the revenues from gas, which is the biggest source of income for the regime itself, are drying up. So they come in smaller sort of flow, which indicates that there won't be any support. Now, fewer wages or no wages at all, and that there would be also the kind of rising that you are saying, you know, the water and the subsidy cancellation, it seems to me a recipe for disaster. And I'm not surprised to hear from what Farouk said about the Dashoguts Velayat protests.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's inevitable, isn't it? Like, these get into the failure of both the energy policy of Turkmenistan as a whole, but also, more specifically, about Berdimuhamedov's economic policy.
Dr. Luca, you touched upon that. Let me expand this question, Bruce, with you. You know, we have been talking about this utility things for years, that it was kind of coming. Now it looks like it's finally gone. Do you see any connection between organization of these games and the cancellation of the free utility services now?
I think they're absolutely connected to each other. You know, we know that Turkmenistan way overspent what it has for money on these games, billions and billions of dollars, and they're going to have to recoup some of this money somehow. I would imagine they've taken loans on some of this stuff, too, that they have to pay back, you know, phenomenal amounts of money, minimum $5 billion construction just for the facilities for the games, $2.3 billion for the airport, new airport. You know, and on and on and on. There's services that they brought in, you know, cooks from outside the country, entertainers, on and on. You know, they've certainly, we don't know what their finances are. I mean, it's always been very opaque. You have to connect the cancellation of these subsidies with the fact that they've spent so much money that they're looking for any source of income they can possibly get their hands on at this moment. And that's, you know, unfortunately, once again, it falls on the citizens of Turkmenistan.
Farouk, earlier you touched upon this, like the protest in Dashoguts, for example. It looks like there are two things. One is cancellation of free utilities. And the second thing is the people in Dashoguts were protesting about is the hike in the price of kindergarten services, right? So do we see the recent cancellation of free utilities are having some sort of chain effect in the price of other commodities? If they are, tell us, please, more on this.
Yes. I mean, the hike in the spike of the price for the kindergarten is directly connected with the abolition of these subsidies, because all of a sudden these institutions, the kindergartens, they realize that once the utilities are not for free, then they would have to pay for them too. So that's why one of the explanations given to those women who gathered in Dashoguts was that there are no free utilities. But I mean, still, it was like tenfold increase. And when I spoke with several people inside the country and asked them why they were protesting against the increase of kindergarten, is it the most important thing to protest about? I mean, why not protest against abolition of free utilities or anything else, or rising prices for food? And what I was told, that these kindergarten fees, they were immediate decision that affect their lives immediately, because they were told to bring 80 manats from tomorrow. while the utilities, they will not be paying until the end of the next month or the end of the year. It didn't come yet. That's why there was this shocking effect for the families who have two or three children, and all of a sudden they were not able to pay for kindergartens. And what I was told in Dashogus, in towns like Dashogus, it was very important for the families to be able to take their kids to kindergartens, because those are the young families who cannot leave them unattended, because otherwise they cannot go to work and they cannot. So this, as Luca said, the Berdimuhamedov's economic policy, I mean, it's having a domino effect. I mean, the cancellation of the subsidies, and then the increase of fees, and increase of the price of other commodities, it's having a domino effect. Yeah. And I'm afraid that the Rubicon, so to speak, is already passed, and it's going to get uglier and uglier and more difficult and more difficult day by day.
Yeah,
for ordinary Turkmens.
Yeah, Faruk, let's come to that subject a little bit later. But the hike in price of the kindergarten, for example, this is one example that we have. What are the other examples we have where recently the price hike been the question?
Everything, all the basic foods, but this kindergarten. Why there was this reaction for kindergarten fees was because it was tenfold, like 1,000%, while other prices, they increased 50 to 100%. According to our calculations, when we compared the prices, for example, for basic staples like sunflower oil or cotton oil, bread and flour, rice, and one of the most important staple as meat and meat products. They increased by 50 to 100%. But it's not as obvious and as outstanding as the tenfold price that came as a shock for many young families in Turkmenistan.
Interesting. Bruce, I think you had a very insightful blog piece on this topic. I'm talking about the People's Council, Halk Maslahati. So Berdimuhamedov is again talking about this. What was significant about the recent discussion on this in Turkmenistan? What they were really trying to do?
Well, it's the second time this year that he's changed the highest legislative body in the country. After he was elected, he said it was going to be the Elders Council, and so that was the understanding. And all of a sudden, he's watered that down. He's saying, okay, now it's still the Elders Council, but we're going to add all these people who are much younger to the process. So he's essentially recreating the old Halk Maslahati that he abolished about a year and a half after he was first elected president. So, but this just shows how much he's foundering, and the government is foundering to try to find some kind of new ideas or new possibilities to get this country back on its feet. It seemed like a kind of a strange decision to begin with, to put a bunch of geriatrics, as the highest legislative body in your country. And somehow or another, he's either figured out that that's not going to work, or I don't know, maybe he just wanted to employ some more people and take some of the bite out of the unemployment figure and decided to let all these new people in and do it. And so now it's the same unwieldy body that the original Halk Maslahati was before, with 2,500 people. What kind of possible decision can you come to? And we know that the only decision they have to come to in the end is to say yes to anything he says. But it just shows that they're totally bankrupt of ideas, and they're just kind of flailing around trying to figure out something that might help their situation that they put themselves into.
These many things are coming together, and you really think maybe it has any connection to the current economic situation of the country or the political situation of the country. Dr. Luca, obviously you want to say something, go ahead with that, but also my question is, do you also see any connection between the current economic crisis in Turkmenistan and discussion about the Halk Maslahati?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Bruce is spot on. And it's much easier to control a body of 2,500 people than a monocameral parliament with 1,525, as at different times. So this shows to me that there's logic of control about that. That you can just, the Majlis would rubber stamp anyway.
Yeah.
But there would have to be some kind of debate. Whereas here, you can just rock up, have a couple of speeches, and they would just go for whatever reforms you want. And so absolutely, institutional adjustment are indicators of a deeper crisis, which is political on the surface, but economic underneath. But also, and this is maybe just an academic point, but I think it's interesting anyway, is the fact that we're seeing Berdimuhamedov doing exactly the same thing in the years of deep. So tampering with institutional framework of Turkmenistan, however flawed that might have been in the first place, is actually an indicator that the two regimes are seeing things from exactly the same position. And, I mean, Niyazov had maybe just higher gas prices to contend with, whereas this guy ended up digging his own political grave, if you want, with that 2007 deal with China, with the opening pipeline 2 years later. But those two regimes actually seen things exactly the same way.
Recently, Putin was also there in Turkmenistan. He has to do anything with all these, what's happening in Turkmenistan today?
I think I view Putin's visit to Turkmenistan and then Berdimuhamedov's subsequent visit to Sochi as purely Putin's opportunism. He knows that these guys are down and that they pretty much have to agree to anything that he suggests at this point, because they need help badly in a number of areas. And it's the economy, it's security along the Afghan border, other things. So him showing up there, because if you look at what Putin agreed to when he was actually in Turkmenistan, I mean, from the press, it wasn't much, cooperation and various things, the usual agreements that are signed like everywhere. There was nothing outstanding, no breaking news that came out of this. But he doesn't go places without a reason. He has hardly ever gone to Turkmenistan at all since Berdimuhamedov has been in. So there was obviously, I know that Berdimuhamedov had visited, and there's a, reciprocal visit that's obligatory. But still, he was holding all the cards when he went to see Berdimuhamedov. And, and interestingly, whatever they talked about, Berdimuhamedov seemed very anxious to get his country back closer into the CIS. When he showed up at Sochi, that was one of his big things. Was he talked about trade among CIS countries, and Turkmenistan wanted to be a part of that. He even talked about how they could improve and intensify links within the CIS, which is not something that we've heard a Turkmen leader say in almost two decades. So it just showed the desperation on the part of Berdimuhamedov. He hasn't said that they've cast out neutrality, but his words say something different. Neutrality apparently is a luxury you can only have when you have some money. And I think that now that they're pretty short on cash, it's time to start talking about cooperation. Yeah. And the CIS cooperation might only be the start of that.
Yeah, I also don't like to misspell what happened there. Dr. Luka, obviously you are our neutrality person here. What happened, like, in terms of this new responsibility that Turkmenistan got there? I don't know, co-chairman of something related to CIS. What was that? And also, what does it say about the neutral states of Turkmenistan?
Well, neutrality was always a very flexible code. They use it for engagement. They use it for disengagement. They use it for isolation. They use it for insulation. So I am not surprised that we've seen, on the surface, it's very surprising that, Turkmenistan, that downgraded its own CIS membership, is now suddenly active and championing this, if you want, disappearing institution. And Bruce is absolutely right. It's a sign of desperation. And again, it's the same political process that happens this time at international level. So there is there's an economic crisis. The domestic response is to raise the price of the kindergarten. International response is to get close to the CIS. The ultimate end of both prongs of this policy is the same, trying to fund some money. They are really scraping the barrels, if you ask me. And my question is, how long can this go on until someone within the regime start to saying, my corruption payment, my bribes, are no longer as generous as they used to be. We should probably find someone else that can pay more. So loyalty can sort of shift quite quickly, and they don't have to be done sort of openly. So this is becoming unsustainable. So I think that we should start seriously querying whether this president is going to be there for the long term. Could be 1 to 2 years, but I can't see this changing, even because there has been no interest whatsoever, at least openly. We haven't heard any interest about changing how the gas policy is framed. And, Turkmenistan does have a very obscure budget, but the economy is pretty simple. It's one resource. So in that sense, if you know how the gas trends are, you can have a good idea about how the budget is. So the regime, the president, keeps going on with the same project.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that they restructured the economy minister and they created a bigger one clearly shows that he now has more control. And choices made so far haven't been successful, to my mind.
Okay. Now, so what all these means, what does the recent decisions tell us about current political, social dynamics and economic health of the country? Is the protest in Dashaghuz say anything about the bigger problem? And what are Turkmenistan's options to come out of this crisis? We will continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Meclis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. We are discussing current economic health and relevant dynamics in Turkmenistan and what's next for the country. Joining me in the discussion are Dr. Lukan Çıstı, Chairman of Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow. Faruk Yusufi is joining us, who's the Director of RFRL's Turkmen Service. Bruce Panier, Editor of Kışlak Avazi, is with us. The blog looks into Central Asia. I'm Mohamed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast here in Washington, D.C. Again, thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us today. So, you know, I was kind of hoping to have this discussion very brief, but the first half kind of eaten up lots of our time. Now, in this part, I have very simple and brief question. That's really where we are today and where are we headed tomorrow? Maybe, Dr. Luka, we can start with you. So what does all these developments, which we just discussed in the first half of the program, tell us about the questions I just raised?
Well, I think that the indicator was a systemic crisis, that the economic model promoted by that kind of political regime is no longer sustainable. It's not sustainable because of the essence itself of the deal with China, which, you know, we talk about many times, that repayments is a pay for loan agreement. It's unsustainable because there are no other export routes. And it's unsustainable because on top of economic restriction, now exacerbated by end of subsidies and this raise in services, we also have an economy that doesn't pay much wages. My guess is that if you don't know where we're going, this is only getting more repressive from now on. And I don't want to imagine what kind of more repressive can mean in Turkmenistan.
Interesting. Bruce, so when we think that the authorities in Turkmenistan really hit the bottom, then President Berdimuhamedov does something which I don't know if the surprise is a good word, maybe confuse everyone. Like today we are talking about the lack of cash. Then what was the golf course about, which he just inaugurated?
No, but that's, you know, I don't really even have words to go and not any words I could use on the radio anyway for this. This was a particular piece of ill-considered planning. You know, at the same time that you're asking people to, you know, marking up their water price, the price of water by, you know, 25 times what it used to cost to lay out this golf course. And of course, golf courses soak up a huge amount of water. You know, it's just like a slap in the face to the people out there, you know, but this is part, you know, this has always been part of the regime, you know, even going back to Niyazov. Now, what they want to do is put this stuff on TV and show that this is progress. This shows that we still got things going. And let's look at some of the comments that Berdimuhamedov has made since IMOG, since the Asian Games were over. He says that they're going to invest tens of billions of dollars into the gas and oil spheres. One, they don't have that much money. Okay, but even that aside, they're not exporting hardly any of this stuff anyway. Why? They have more gas, you know, that they're storing than they know what to do with right now. They aren't selling to hardly anybody. Oil, SOCAR, that just came out the other day, you know, about a week ago, and said that they had a new deal to ship Turkmen oil through the Baku Tbilisi Ceyhan pipeline. But they said that while this year they might ship 6 million tons, which is not very much, of Turkmen oil, next year it'll be 4 million tons. So even that's falling through for them. you know, so they keep this brave face. And of course, they've mentioned that the construction of TAPI on Turkmen territory will be done, you know, by, well, I think the middle of next year or something. But so what? That's the only part of the pipeline that's going to be built. So they, you know, it's the same game of like, you know, forget about the details of this or where we're going with this 2 or 3, 5 years down the road. Let's just talk about right now. Everything's fantastic. We're going to start. We're spending money all over the place. It's going to bring all kinds of money back, you know, and don't worry about it. We got everything under control. When in fact, when you look at these projects and what he's talking about, they're absurd. They don't, you know, they don't have the money for it. The projects go nowhere, you know, but like I said, this was in the past, they could get away with that because some of this stuff really would happen, like the pipeline to China. But 2 years from now, when people are going, well, what happened with our gas export pipeline? What happened with the money we put into developing oil fields to sell that? You know, and make some more money. Is none of that true? And the answer is none of it is true.
So, Farooq, what does this economic situation tell us about the political health of the country? I want to refer here especially Berdimuhamedov's own political capital.
Yeah, first of all, we have to say that there is no political system anymore in Turkmenistan. No political system, no economical policy. And all of these things, like the golf course and him visiting different military sites and showing off his skills of shooting or his meetings with leaders of other countries like Putin, it's all distraction and it's all attempt to pacify people, to calm them down, saying that, you see, we can afford this kind of things and that we can afford inviting so many people, so many rich people to the country. Everything is going to be okay, but everything is not going to be okay, at least for majority of the Turkmen people. And Turkmen people, judging from what happened in Dashoğlu last week, started realizing that it's not going to be okay.
Now, we have been talking about this dire economic situation for years, but really nothing is happening. We are not seeing any political consequences to the regime. People are surviving. They are living their own life. Perhaps, is it possible that we are reading a wrong book here, Dr. Luka?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it seems to me that the unsustainability of this economic management is becoming very evident. And it will lead to change in the way in which the regime deals with the population, inevitably. You know, what Ruth was saying before, the fact that building up a golf course in the desert while raising the water rates, this is becoming super authoritarian, you know, to show how out of touch this was. One of the things which Niyazov did was always making sure the population had not enough to complain about when it comes to the economy in that sense, even though it was never wealth. But here, I think that we are getting over a threshold. And to me, the response of that is just more authoritarian, more repression, if possible. But I don't think that we are over-dramatizing what's going on. The signals are there. I mean, these people have been banning private fishing, canceling all of these subsidies they have for 20 years. Water become very expensive. Everything, like the shops are empty of goods. So it is become, you know, and there is a point that which you realize that I need to feed my family. So people could start to be a little bit more responsive in that sense. I'm not sure what Bruce and Farooq think about it, but to me, and I'm an externer, I mean, don't get me wrong, this seems unsustainable. Even within the, if you want, the idiosyncrasies of this regime, this is getting to a new level.
Okay. Bruce, Farooq, do you want to add something into this?
I have my own theory. I mean, as I said, we passed the line where there is no way back. We passed the Rubicon, and it all now depends how people will react. And we are already seeing that people are reacting very unhappily. The only way for regime to survive for some time, as Luka noted, is to strengthen the repression. And then we might see another North Korea type of rule, North Korea type of regime in Central Asia. But in North Korea has been isolated much stricter for many years, and they can afford to rule people. But Turkmenistan is a little bit different situation. I don't want to say it's open, but it's not as closed and it's not as isolated by international community, a country. and anything can happen. I don't want to predict a doomsday for Turkmenistan, but things are going to get ugly, I think.
Okay, so to things not to get ugly, what can Berdimuhamedov do in how much time he got to do this?
Well, there's only two things I can see that he can do. One, he can tap into his own bank, his bank accounts outside of Turkmenistan, which he's probably unlikely to do. He might have already been doing that to pay for some of the Asian indoor games, the airport. We don't know. Certainly, he made that mysterious visit to Germany a while back, and Farouk was there, and you know, he met briefly with Merkel, but it seems like the main point of his visit was to meet with the bankers. So he's got that money, which might be able to help prop the country up for a little while. The other solution, which we've been saying for a couple years now, is he's got to let on short contracts. He would bring in so much investment and so many companies into that country if he would agree to give out onshore contracts, but that necessitates a presence of all these, you know, foreigners in his country, the representatives of these investment firms, financial institutions, things like that. They're going to want to keep track of where their money is going, how it's being spent, as the Chinese did with the pipeline. That was part of the deal. The Chinese built the pipeline, they loaned all the money, but the deal was that the Chinese had to be on the ground to see what was going on and make sure that the money they were spending was being spent on what it was supposed to be spent on. And he has shown that he is unwilling to do that. That might have been part of his talks with Russia, maybe, you know, to see if they had any interest in maybe investing in some onshore projects. But I mean, he needs massive amounts. He has to pretty much open up the country very soon to get the kind of money he needs to keep that government afloat.
Bruce, as you were saying, maybe he's unwilling, maybe he's not capable of doing that. I think you also mentioned, Bruce, they are bankrupt of new ideas. So in terms of solution, if Berdimuhamedov is not that guy, is there any way around to work about the solution of this crisis excluding him, Dr. Luka?
Well, it will have to come from within.
Yeah.
It will let from within.
No, so, I'm not at all referring to any kind of revolution, whatever, but is there any other way?
No, I mean, I think there would have to be his own support that would turn against him and get rid of him. I mean, I just want to make a step back, just to connect what Bruce was saying. What we're seeing happening in Uzbekistan with all of this, you know, very small sort of changes going on, but significant nonetheless, to me, point to the same direction, which is opening up the country for more investment, increasing the investment climate, you know, better human rights, however slow this is, may indicate a new welcoming. So they sort of could just copy those little changes and make a few things sort of go that way in the short term. It's not that complicated. So to me, is the fact that they are nurturing their own narrative and they keep saying that things are fine. But I would be very surprised if we don't hear more and more in the next few months about literary shuffles across any level. So now, getting rid of four or five ministers in one day, or four or five Hakim in the Velayat, in one day.
Which he's already doing,
It's indicating crisis. I mean, when you get rid of four of your five governors, it indicates they're going against you. So if we see that, indicates that the crisis is going. If we don't see that, it maybe mean that it's not able to do that anymore. So I guess we should start look at Turkmenistan now with the sort of Sovietology eyes that our professors taught 20, 25 years, 30 years ago. And, you know, it may not get pretty, but I think that kind of development are inevitable.
Maybe, Farouk, let's end this discussion with your local perspective on this. So what is the best option for the Turkmen authorities to get out of this?
I mean, the best option for Turkmens would be that Mr. Berdimuhamedov abdicates himself. But, I mean, this is unrealistic. So, I mean, the best option for the Turkmen government would be, and for President Berdimuhamedov, start listening and start encouraging his seasoned ministers like Meredov and a couple other economists to give ideas on how to reform political system and reform economy of the country, and encourage them really to come forward and start opening up the country, as Bruce, I think, suggested, that bring in more foreign investors and be a little bit less greedy, I would say, and give some air to people so that people start living a little bit better lives.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, I'm desperately trying to end this discussion with some positive note. You know, whatever the politics behind that was, this Asian Games, despite these billions of investments, brought some new people to the country from abroad. So is there anything Turkmen authorities can cash from that to do some good?
They even blew that opportunity. You know, I mean, they kept such guests as arrived were kept to a 10 or 15 square block area, right, or confined to just that. They didn't let in much of the foreign media. If they'd been a little bit more savvy on this thing, they would have let foreign media come in. And even if they restricted their movements, they would have taken them to some of the, historical places in Turkmenistan. Nisa, for instance, is the old ruins of the Parthian Empire, is just outside Ashgabat. And they could have brought foreign journalists out there and said, go ahead, take pictures, film, show that we got something to do. But they didn't even do that. Once you got into the country, you were essentially locked up in this one zone where all the games were, and no one even got a chance to see anything else in Turkmenistan. So they lost a huge advertising opportunity there. It's unclear to me exactly how many foreigners even attended that, you know, just as spectators. You know, we know more or less how many athletes came in, but how many people really did fly in and buy tickets and go and see these games? It's unclear to me. Certainly we saw some footage from Turkmen TV. What I saw indicated that most of the audience were locals who I assume were forced to buy tickets and go and see it. So, it should have been an opportunity to showcase what Turkmenistan had and try to get some people to come and visit the place, some tourism opportunities, but they didn't even take advantage of that.
Such a complicated topic. Anyway, we can't get to the bottom of the decades-old problem in 40 minutes, but I hope the discussion has been helpful in highlighting some of the tipping points. So thank you very much, Dr. Lukan Çiftçi, Chairman of Central Asian Studies Center at the University of Glasgow, Faruk Yusupi, Director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Turkmen Service, Bruce Panier, Editor of Kishlok Owozi, which is Araf Yaril's blog focusing on Central Asia. Once again, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.